Elizabeth Highfield, a story by Simon Haywood, read by Shona Lee. He was an old man already, but it was his ruined leg that ended his days at sea. They took him on as keeper of the Serpent Light on North Rock, half a mile from the Shears. Admiralty policy was always to have two men on each light, but there'd been trouble of some sort, and the Admiralty had sent him on ahead, promising that a partner would be engaged and sent after us as soon as possible. It was irregular, and they could see that he knew it, but he had to take what he could get these days, and so it seemed did they. So he went out. It was a night-time life he led on North Rock. Every hour, on the hour, every night, he would limp alone up the crooked stairs, trim the thick rope-like wicks of the great revolving lamps, and top up the creaking reservoirs with oil. Then he'd return to the little parlour, and sit by the hearth and wait for an hour, while the Admiralty chronometer dryly measured the silence amid the weather and the leagues of sea beyond the walls. The parlour was sparse but comfortable. A black iron staircase spiralled to the sleeping quarters and the light above, and a door led to the gallery kitchen. At the right elbow of his chair in the parlour stood a cabinet, and next to that a stone plaque which bore the names of the ship Serpent and the names of its 51 passengers and crew wrecked and lost on the Shears 144 years before. As every schoolchild knew, the Serpent Light was the Admiralty's first and oldest lighthouse, the first fruits of an outraged flood of subscriptions which followed the loss of the Serpent. The keeper read and wrote on laboriously. Over time he teased fragments of names, one at a time, from the marble plaque. Captain Paul Clarence, David and William Mannering, brothers and sailors, Reverend John something, couldn't quite read it. The old man didn't wonder much about these long-dead passengers and crew. He saved his readings for the logbooks and almanacs of his work, but he acknowledged these names gravely as those of fellow travellers on the sea. In the day he slept, and walked about the lighthouse on its bare pedestal of rock, oiled and tended the mechanisms of the revolving lamps, and watched the weather and the gulls. At night he fed the lamps again. The passage of regular trade ships could normally be predicted within a day or so, and one bitter night he was waiting for a big Admiralty freighter to pass by on its return voyage from the south. 1 o'clock had struck, and he had shuffled up to the light, trimmed the wicks, topped up the reservoirs, and shuffled down. He had not long been settled in his chair with his pipe and knitting to wait for the 2 o'clock check, when, to his astonishment, there was a knock at the door, or so it seemed. It was a blow to the timbers, far too steady and regular to seem like the battering of the wind. Startled, he turned and watched the door, straining to hear. The knock came again, unmistakably a knock and a call. Help! Help! The old man limped to the door and wrenched it open, and to his shock, the thick darkness in the doorway framed the outline of a woman, shivering, with hair drenched and clothes heavy with seawater. He pulled her inside. Are you alone? He asked quickly, thinking of other survivors out on the rock in the darkness. She shuddered. She did not respond. Are you alone? Is anyone with you? He demanded. My father, she stammered, and my brothers. Are they out there? She shook her head. Gone, she whispered. Gone. When? Today? Yesterday? Are they alive? Is anyone alive? No, she whispered. How? When? So many questions. Was it a ship? Was it a boat? But she said nothing. She stood within the draughty doorway, her shoulders hunched, her pale arms clasped under her breast. And the old seaman was angry, begrudging her his pity. This was a well-to-do young woman. Her family might well have a yacht if they lived near the coast. And, well, quite frankly, such people were careless sailors. He sighed again and barred the door. Well, it's done now, he said. He took her arm and guided her to his chair. She was unsteady on her feet, huddled on the chair's edge, shivering, and the old man fetched blankets from the chest and threw them about her. Her fingers curled listlessly around their creases. He went to the galley and put on a kettle of water to boil. You'll be chilled, he called. Wrap up in those blankets. He meant that she should take off her wet dress, but he couldn't say it. He closed the galley door behind him and made hot tea, lacing it with sugar and whiskey. There was silence. And when the tea was made, he knocked at the closed door. Come in, she said, distractedly, like a child speaking to a servant. Mugs in hand, he opened the door with an elbow. She was wrapped in the blankets. The dress was a sodden heap on the floor. He gave her one of the mugs and then stood to pick up the dress and drape it over the fireguard. Silently, the dress began to steam. She sipped the tea, warmed her hands on it, and coughed. And he kept his eyes off her. There was a pause. What are you going to do with me? She asked. Well, I'll flag down a boat first thing tomorrow, he said. I'll put you on it. She seemed to give a slight nod. Sipped her tea again. The old man rose and stamped up the staircase to rummage in a chest for dry clothes. There were spare dungaree jumpers, trousers and a monkey jacket, and he pulled them out and eyed them uncertainly. Many years before, he had watched a woman dress herself in the morning, and she had been no gentlewoman, but one who had dressed and gone her way, leaving him, when he returned from the sea, two graves to tend. A large and a small. That came to his mind at odd times now. He gazed resentfully at the jumper and trousers, limped downstairs. Here, he said. They're dry at least. You can go upstairs. Thank you, she said. She took the jumper and trousers and laid them on the arm of the chair. The Admiralty'll have to know, he said. She nodded again. The fire crackled, the dress steamed. I'm sorry, she said at last, looking at him mournfully. It is so cold and lonely out in the sea. He shook his head again. Her grief was too out of place, too fresh. This was his tower, and gradually and silently he had peopled its shadows with old friends, lost in storms long stilled, mourned on cramped shipboard by men who know their chances of going next, and with a woman who'd never told him about a girl child he'd never seen. His life had been filled with such deaths, and now it was drawing to a close, here, alone, at bay, tending a single, endlessly repeating warning from the only room safe from the sea. And with that, his anger was spent. I suppose you weren't to know, he found himself saying. She was weeping now, sat back in the chair, arms open, palms upwards. Clumsily, he leaned forward and patted her hand, and then he squeezed it and lightly. Her fingers echoed his grasp, and at his touch she crumpled towards him, flung her arms around him and buried her face in his breast and sobbed. He held her, awkwardly, unused to comforting, and then she looked up. Tears and the sea stained her face and hair, but her face was so close to his. Suddenly he caught the perfume of her breath, and it was sweet. The blanket, had half slid from her shoulder. He wanted to push her away, but she clung to him. He had expected nothing of this, but old memory and desire stirred in him and drowned the surprise, and his head fell forward, and they were kissing, and he tasted salt. They lay together before the little fire on the blankets, and when it was over and they'd rested a little, she seemed to wake and pulled herself up from him suddenly. "I'm sorry," she said again. "What? Why?" He protested. It ought to be me that's sorry," he added plaintively. "No," she said. She got up and walked frankly naked over to where her wet dress was steaming on the fire guard and began to pull it roughly on. He watched the changes in the mood of her body. "I have brought you into it now, forever," she said. She settled her dress over herself, pulled her draggled hair out of the neck and stood frowning at him and sighed. "Who are you?" he asked. "Elizabeth Highfield," she said. "And I am so sorry." She repeated this. And then she said again that it was so cold and lonely out in the sea. She unbarred the door, hauled it open. There was a gust, heavy with rain and spray, and then she was gone. He called out, struggled to his feet, fumbling to wrap a blanket round himself, limped to the gaping doorway, and over the dark shapes of rock and wave, she was nowhere to be seen. He was completely, utterly alone. He stood a minute, staring, and then, with cold certainty, he understood and shut the door and limped back to the parlour. Oh, he was very tired now, but his mind was utterly clear. Knowing what he would find, he looked up to the marble plaque on the parlour wall and, spelling the letters laboriously out, he found the last names of the Reverend John Highfield and his sons, John and Charles, and his daughter, Elizabeth, lost in the wreck of the Serpent. He considered, perhaps, and he thought it likely, a little boat, a lifeboat, a dinghy maybe had escaped, but foundered in the sea, remote and ever lonely from the wreck. He would never fully know. Then came the dry whir of the Admiralty chronometer, as he knew it would. And now he was listening, as one after the other the little bells of the half-hour chimed. It was 3:30. An hour ago, perhaps longer, the reservoirs had run dry, unnoticed, while he had lain on the parlour floor, and the great lamps had guttered and gone out, and the treacherous rocks of the shears had been cloaked in darkness again to wait for unwary ships. Oh, as they had waited for the Serpent 144 years before. Already, intermittently now, he listened across 1/2 mile of wind. There came the yawn and splinter of rending timbers of the big Admiralty freighter, and the sobs and pleas of the living and the dying rising and falling with the waves. The old man could do nothing but sit in the parlour chair and listen for the silence, as if the silence might bring him something, a gift or a memory.